Calling the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 8th, and let the record reflect that the time is 1:32 p.m. Today we have present our Vice Chair, Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. I'd like to recognize that we have Representative Annie Josephson in the audience, and I thought I saw Representative Gary Knopf. There he is. So thank you for joining us today. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you to Nancy Hemingway with Senate Records and Eric Heimbigner with LAO, and to Mr. Witt, our aide. And we're going to continue where we left off on our discussion on Wednesday. So that is the item on the agenda, Senate Bill 32, Crime Sentencing Mental Illness Evidence. And on Wednesday, February 6th, the committee was given an introduction of the bill by the Attorney General, the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, and the Commissioner of Correction. And I'll pause here for a moment to welcome Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Deputy Attorney General Rob Henderson then began talking the committee through a review of the bill section by section. And today we will pick up where we left off and continue that overview. And then tomorrow, February 9th, we will hold public testimony. During those initial hearings, the committee is vetting the bill, but is not considering amendments, and my office is not preparing any changes to the bill at this time. I begin with these remarks because after consulting with Legislative Ethics and Counsel, in accordance with AS 24.60.030, it has come to my attention that I may have an indirect conflict on this legislation. My office is working to ensure the public is heard and the integrity of this legislative process is above reproach. With that, I would like to welcome Deputy Attorney General Rob Henderson to the table. And while he approaches the committee, I would like to ask our members here at the table to keep your questions concise and comments germane to the bill. I'd also like you to keep your questions as focused on the material at hand as possible. What we will have today, I believe, will be a very informative discussion. And on Wednesday, we did not leave a whole lot of time to review the bill because of our general discussion. So I really would like to focus directly on the bill today. So Mr. Henderson, welcome to Senate Judiciary. Please place your name on the record and begin your presentation. I believe that section 20 or 21, and where we'll continue. And if you have questions on the first, what we went over, let's wait till the end so we can hopefully get through the bill today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Department of Law. Before I begin my sectional analysis, I just want to reaffirm for the committee what the primary purpose of SB 32 does. What SB 32 does and what the goal of 32 is to return that discretion to the prosecutors and to the judges to ensure that adequate sentences are allowed under the law and allow judges to impose those sentences when necessary. One of the things that we saw on SB 91 was that there was a significant focus on the rehabilitation of the offender with a less of a focus on the victim and the community. And that is contrary to the sentencing criteria that we have to follow as prosecutors. So one of the things that SB 32 does is it really focuses on those other sentencing criteria, including the seriousness of the offense, restoration of the victim, and the reaffirmation of societal norms. That does not say that rehabilitation is not an important factor. It will always remain an important factor, but it can't be the only factor that is considered. So with that, I'm going to go into my sectional. I'll start at section 21, which is, I believe, where we left off. Section 21, page 11. This is a conforming amendment to the change that occurs in section 22, page 12. Making failure to appear a criminal offense, a crime. Section 22 amends the crime of failure to appear when somebody is on release of bail conditions. SB 91 made failure to appear a violation punishable by a $1,000 fine unless the offender absconded for more than 30 days. Section 22 removes this 30-day grace period for the offenders who have failed to appear and who fail to make contact with the court. Or if the person fails to appear at court with the intent to avoid prosecution. Failure to appear is a C felony if the person is on release conditions for a felony. It is an A misdemeanor if the person is on release conditions for a misdemeanor. Moving on to Section 23. Section 23 amends the crime of violating conditions of release. So SB 91 actually, as amended by SB 54, made all violating conditions of release a Class B misdemeanor.
I'll pause for a minute. Senator Reinbold has a question.
Thank you. And Mr. Henderson, can you explain, is this going exactly back to pre-SB 91 and Sections 22 or 23? Are there any changes? And I'm sure this is going to be a consistent theme, you know, throughout this whole process. We'd really like to see where you guys have made adjustments and where, you know, there is a full repeal.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Reinbold, this Sections 22, the amendments to failure to appear, is a straight repeal going back to SB 91.
Pre-SB
91. I apologize. Thank you. Pre-SB 91. Pre-2016. Section 23, the amendment to violating conditions of release, similarly, this is a takes us back to pre-2016 law.
Thank you. Okay.
So Section 23, violating conditions of release. So SB 91, as I was saying, as amended by SB 54 in 2017, made all violations of conditions of release a Class B misdemeanor punishable by up to 5 days in jail. This section amends the crime of violating conditions of release to make it a Class A misdemeanor if the person is violates their conditions while on conditions of release for a felony, and makes it a Class B misdemeanor if they violate their conditions of release while on conviction, or excuse me, while on release for a misdemeanor.
You do? Oh, I do. I'm sorry. Senator Reinbold has a question.
Okay, and my memory may not be serving me well, but I thought that pre-SB 91, if you violated condition of release for a felony, it was a C felony, and this is saying it's a Class B misdemeanor for violating misdemeanors, and Class A misdemeanor if you violate felony, is that correct?
So through the Chair, Senator Reinbold, Section 23 makes it a Class A misdemeanor if the person is released from a charge for a felony, and a Class B misdemeanor if they're released from on bail on a misdemeanor. I do not have my statute book from 2014. Let me see if you bring me 14.
That's ridiculous.
So I don't have the law in front of me to look back to pre-2016, but my memory serves that it was a class, that this is a straight return to pre-2016.
And I'll just add, the study in my office is that is correct, okay. But please do verify that officially. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, and just maybe a little help with the thought process behind this for the non-attorney. The conditions of release has to do with what you shouldn't be allowed to do when you're out on some original offense. And we have those conditions to try and get you to behave well as you get back into being a functional member of society. So the penalty for that under SB 54, if you break those, is you get yanked back into prison on your original sentence. Is that right?
So through the Chair, Senator, if you violate your conditions of release on bail, the court has the authority to revoke that bail and impose new bail on the underlying offense. What violating conditions of release allows is a new criminal charge for violating conditions of release, for not following the court's order. So it's an additional sanction. It's an additional incentive for the offender that if they're going to be released on bail, that there are there's a consequence if you fail to follow that those bail orders.
And so just, and I apologize, follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So this only applies pre-conviction. This is only when you're out on bail.
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct. Violating conditions release is pre-conviction.
Okay.
It's not, well, you're on bail release.
Is there, thank you, Madam Chair, any concern that this process of stacking up additional criminal charges tends to sort of get in the way of dealing with the original offense, that you stack up charges and after on top of charges, and eventually somebody just pleads to whatever is efficient, and then your prosecutors don't have the ability when they ask a judge for a sentence to deal with the underlying criminality, the thing that got us started in the first place?
So through the chair, Senator, I may be a little confused by your question. Prosecutors will always have the ability to advocate for the appropriate sentence on the underlying offense, separate and distinct from the existence of a violating conditions of release. Now, there are times where that violating conditions of release may be joined for purposes of trial or purposes of resolution to that underlying offense, but there are also times where that violating conditions of release can be and sometimes is charged as a separate offense, separate case number. Let me put it that way, a separate case number.
Need more clarification, Senator Keel?
Maybe after the committee meeting. My observation, limited as it is that as charges stack up and the potential cost to prosecute starts to stack up, sometimes somebody's offered a deal, and sometimes you don't plead on the single most serious or original offense. You plead on something else. So my concern is that we start to sort of stack up situations where we're not dealing with the thing that got us into the criminal situation in the first place. And that may be such a limited experience that I've lacked perspective. So I would welcome a conversation more on that topic.
Through the chair, Senator, I'm happy to have that conversation with you.
Thank you.
I can tell you, just for the record, there are lots of reasons why a case would be resolved. It's really fact-dependent and fact-specific and case-specific. So.
Hey. Senator Machicki, you have a question?
Just to make sure I understand it for the record, in violating conditions of release, the way it was before 91 is the way it is returning right now, which is a full repeal, and the reason why we want there to be a stick is you're already releasing someone with a deal. You're saying we're going to release you free trial if you meet these certain requirements, and without those requirements being met, there's a consequence, right?
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct.
And these are reasonable consequences that are scaled to the type of crime for which they're being held.
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct.
I think that's a reasonable approach. I think that's possibly what's missing and why folks are upset about the direction that we took in the previous bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so I'm going to just add where my concern is. I see the chart now where violating conditions of release, which to me is they are getting released. And so, by goodness, there's a lot of times not all that many conditions that can be imposed upon them. Pre-SB 91, I see that we're returning the violations of conditions of release, what was prior to SB 91, so a Class A misdemeanor if it was a felony. So they're still only getting a misdemeanor, even if they were charged with a felony, A, B, C, and I don't know if unclassified felony is in there. But then they are getting a Class B misdemeanor for offense, which was a misdemeanor. And as we know, pre-SB 91, misdemeanor A's were 0 to 365 days, and misdemeanor B's were 0 to 90 days, if my memory serves me correctly. And then under SB 91, misdemeanors were reduced down to 0 to 10 days. That was misdemeanor B, and misdemeanor A's were 0 to 30 days. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct. And we're going to get to that section of this bill. Just so the record's clear, SB 91 reduced Class B misdemeanors from 90 days down to 10 days. and Class A misdemeanors from 365 days down to 30 days, absent aggravating factors or certain offenses.
Senator Reinbold.
And through the chair, so my whole point of this whole discussion was misdemeanor A's and B's were just dramatically reduced anyway. When they were released, it was up to a $1,000 fine. When we fixed it in, not really fixed it, but when we addressed it in 54, it was still only a cap of up to 5 days, which was, that's why I kept arguing we're not doing very much in 54. There was this false narrative out there that we did so much in 54, which we didn't. You know, we did a step in the right direction.
Senator Reinbold, excuse me, let's focus on what we're doing now at hand, and you will get to how those all are going to change in coming sections.
Right.
Senator Reinbold.
And we are addressing Section 22 and 23 right now. That's exactly what I'm discussing in this right now, that the misdemeanor A's and B's, because they're going to be getting a misdemeanor A and a B for violating, so it's completely germane to
well,
what we're
I understand,
doing.
But I don't want to talk about SB 54 at this point. I want to talk about SB 32. So continue, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moving on.
We do have another question. I'm so sorry. Senator Keel.
I apologize. Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 22. A little more sort of the reasoning, if you would, the language that's in the law that you'd be repealing, it gives the ability to cure may not be the word. You're not going to get a crime for violating your conditions of release if within 30 days you get in touch with a court. This would delete that. And I guess the question is, does that rob us of discretion in the situation where somebody is on bail and they make a mistake? I mean, oversleeping maybe, but I don't know, you're in a car wreck, whatever. Do we now have a situation where somebody doesn't want to get in touch with the court, they have now an incentive, as you put it, to skip town rather than show up?
So through the chair, Senator, that's a great question. And that protection, that circumstance that you just described, is already covered in the law, that person has an affirmative defense. So if you were to look at 1156, 730, sub B, in the prosecution for failure to appear, it is the affirmative defense that unforeseeable circumstances outside the person's control prevented the person from appearing before court or judicial officer at the time and place of the scheduled hearing. And the person contacts the court orally and in writing immediately upon being able to contact. That provision, that affirmative defense, remains in law with SB 32. It existed pre-SB 91. So that the scenario that you described where somebody oversleeps and they're not able to make it to court is not going to be covered under those factual scenarios with this change.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
Okay. Moving on to Section 24. Section 24 makes it a Class A misdemeanor to refuse to provide a DNA sample when arrested for a qualifying offense. Under current law, those arrested for a qualifying offense must provide a DNA sample for inclusion into the DNA database. However, although the law requires they provide a DNA sample upon arrest, there's no enforcement mechanism of that provision. And so what Sections 24 it does is it allows for or creates that enforcement mechanism. That is the new criminal offense. So Section 25 clarifies.
Mr. Henderson, yes. So that actually is a going above and beyond a repeal because that's an added tool that we didn't have before. I just want to point that out for the public's sake. Senator Keel.
Thank you. So under existing law, I mean, does law enforcement have the opportunity to get a judge's order to take DNA from someone who's refusing? Or are there any other mechanisms in place today without this bill?
So through the chair, Senator, the mechanism would be would have to have the court hold somebody in contempt until they provided that DNA sample, and that is a very that's a struggle because one of the things that the Alaska Court of Appeals has held is that the prosecution doesn't actually have the authority to file contempt charges. Only the court has the authority to authorize the filing of a contempt charge, and so it would be a very inefficient mechanism. to obtain that DNA sample. By creating the crime of, well, let me rephrase, by creating the enforcement mechanism of providing or requiring a DNA sample in violation upon arrest, it provides law enforcement the tools necessary to obtain that DNA sample through a new criminal offense.
And just to follow up, thank you. So the reason for this is to catch cold cases. That's why we're doing this?
Through the chair, Senator, that's exactly it. The DNA database, it's called CODIS, the combined DNA.
I'm not going to remember it.
The DNA registration database is an incredibly powerful and important law enforcement tool. It has allowed us to solve some very important cases throughout the years. And this is an important tool when people are arrested and they've committed a qualifying offense. Being able to get their DNA into the system as quickly as possible can really protect the public downstream.
Mr. Henderson, would you characterize this as perhaps closing a loophole? Because it seems odd to me in criminal statutes there would be a requirement when arresting a suspect where you wouldn't have a penalty or the tool to enforce it. So do you think that was just something overlooked?
Madam Chair, I think that's exactly it. This is a gap. This was a gap, a loophole that needed to be closed. And this sections 24 through 26 act do that.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Michiki.
Just curious if the required refusal or the required submittal of a DNA sample and a charge for refusal has passed constitutional muster around the U.S. Has it been tested? Have we evaluated it here for?
Through the chair, Senator, I can't recall as I sit here right now whether it has been challenged in Alaska or not. This is a common. This is a tool that is used throughout the country. CODIS is a database that is a very robust system, and so it would be. I have confidence to believe that it would be the constitutionality would be upheld, and it may actually have already been. I just can't remember as I sit here right now.
Perhaps you could that could be some follow up. You could see if it has been tested in court.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I can do that. Absolutely.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Michiki?
I just agree. It's a powerful tool. It's very important. I just worry about our Alaskans' right to privacy. Since that has not been adequately defined, it can be a fairly expansive definition, I would think, in the courts. But I'm just curious if there has been any case law, if you have a chance to evaluate.
Madam, through the chair, Senator, a couple things to remember, and why it would be it would not be an a violation of someone's privacy. So the qualifying offenses are very specific and unique. They are crimes against a person and felony DUI. It's only those two types of offenses that would give rise to this. So it's not any time you're arrested. And then we've actually added protections on the back end or in the system that, in the event that the person is acquitted of the charge or the court dismisses those charges and the person's not retried, if any of those sorts of things happen, the DNA is actually removed from the system. So that's that balance between privacy, one's personal privacy, and the need to ensure the public has the information necessary to help solve some of these cold cases.
Thank you for that added information. That's very good to know. Senator Reingold.
Thank you. And I would like to add to the discussion of this. when someone is involved in criminal activity and violated, you know, a child, but in domestic violence or assault or something like that, and especially if they already have a record, I mean, they do lose some of their rights. And to me, the Constitution talks very strictly about protecting the public. So it's very constitutional to protect the public. Also, this helps with a speedy trial, which is very constitutional. In addition, it helps avoid wrongful convictions. So I actually think this is a very important tool for law enforcement.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Thiel.
Just a question and a half on exactly this. You said the things for which we take DNA are specific and unique, and I may have misread the cross-reference. I thought it was 100% of felonies plus any crime against a person.
Let me look. Excuse me. Through the chair, Senator, let me look right now.
The odds are good that I'm just misreading the cross-references.
So, through the chair, Senator, it's AS 4441035 sub B. The Department of Public Safety shall collect for inclusion in the DNA identification system a blood sample or both for a person convicted of a crime in this state for a felony convicted in this state of a crime against a person or a felony under Title 11 or 2835, which is felony DUI. I'm going to drop down to six, which is the arrest. A person arrested for a crime against a person or a felony under AS 11 or felony DUI. So you're right, Senator. It is any crime against a person. So that would include misdemeanor domestic violence offenses. Any felony and felony DUI.
Thank you. That helps. Then the other half of the question was, I noticed that sometimes it's a felony and sometimes it's a misdemeanor. Given that you kind of stated one, and that's sections 25 and 26, I may be jumping ahead, Madam Chair. You've stated kind of one purpose, help us investigate crimes. Why is it sometimes a C felony to refuse to help us and sometimes an A misdemeanor to help us?
Sure. So, through the chair, Senator, you're absolutely right. So, to help put this in context, you're reading both sections 25 and 26. So, sections 25 make the violating an order of to submit a DNA sample a C felony if convicted, and a misdemeanor. That's section 26 is a misdemeanor if arrested. So, this is that balance, which is if you fail to provide a DNA sample upon arrest, the crime that you're committing is a misdemeanor. If you fail to provide a DNA sample upon conviction, it's a C felony. And the current law is that if you fail to provide a DNA sample upon conviction, it's a C felony. This is adding that misdemeanor. That's where I come back to Section 24. This is adding that enforcement mechanism specific as to arrest. We've had the enforcement mechanism as to convictions. Now we're adding it to arrest.
Thank you. Continue.
Madam Chair, I had a follow-up. If I was possibly understood as not supporting the collection of DNA evidence, I am, just to make it clear for everyone, the general public. There's a lot of things I'd like to do, but that pesky Constitution often gets in the way, and my request was to make sure that pesky Constitution wasn't going to get in the way this time in this case. I think it's important that we know that. Because if the law is challenged, the entire law is challenged, and we'd like to know that we're passing something that is going to survive.
I appreciate that, and I will say that I've had those same frustrations with ideas that I've come up with and realized that wouldn't pass muster. So,
through the chair, Senator, I will get you that answer, and I will provide it to the committee. I'll provide it to Madam Chair and committee. So, I'm going to move to Section 27. Section 27. Section 27, this is new. This is the creation of a new law. This is not related to SB 91. Section 27 enacts a new criminal offense of a generalized threat statute to cover situations when an individual threatens to commit a serious crime of violence, which reasonably places another person in fear. This section and this new criminal offense really focuses on the effect of the threat, not on its falsity. And so I say that because the prior terroristic threatening, the prior law of terrorist threatening, was designed and implemented as the legislative commentary to that. It was an aggravated form of making a false report. So under current law, terroristic threatening is only a crime if the threat is false. What this does is it changes that, and it includes both real and false threats. This Section 27 focuses on the, as I said, the effect of the threat on the listener, not its falsity.
Mr. Henderson, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the law prior allow it to be a crime if it was, the threat was imminent or if it was false? But if the threat basically were without imminency, we still, it would still be a crime if a threat is posed, whether it's true or false, but the imminent factor does not have to be present. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so, Madam Chair, so under the crime of assault in the fourth degree, misdemeanor assault, you, if you make a threat, if you place somebody in fear by words or conduct, that is a misdemeanor assault. If that threat, if those words or conduct has an immediacy component to it, so it has to be an immediate threat. It can't be, I'm going to beat you up next week. That is not an assault for. Under terrorist threatening, which is a separate crime, separate distinct from assault in the fourth degree, the threat had to be false. What this does is it fixes that. It creates this new offense that criminalizes a generalized threat statute. These types of generalized threat statutes really allow us to allow law enforcement to have that intervention when necessary. When they receive reports of a threat of a school shooting, threat of some type of catastrophic event, the bomb threat, that sort of thing. This allows law enforcement to take immediate action to intervene and not wait until that threat is either imminent or that person has taken a substantial threat, a substantial step. Also, these generalized threat statutes have been upheld across the country. Meeting the First Amendment, these types of threats, because what you're talking about is recklessly placing somebody in fear of serious physical injury, a serious crime, it does not infringe upon somebody's First Amendment right.
Can you, I understand the intent, particularly when we think of this, the safety of our children in the schools and people in public buildings and malls and such, and in places where people congregate. I just want to make sure that we aren't going to extend the crime of terroristic threatening to a situation where two people are at a bar and they get in a fight and one threatens the other one, because the way, if you look on page 13 under section 27, A, B, C, and D, they're joined at the end by the little word or. So if you just look at A, it says placing a person in reasonable fear of serious physical injury to any person. So is there going to be any confusion that if the guy in the bar says he's going to smash the other guy's face, that he would not be charged with a crime of terroristic threatening? Because I don't think that is what you intend, and I don't think that is what this crime is about.
Madam Chair, you're correct. The factual scenario that you just described is not what the new crime of terrorist threatening is designed to capture. The conduct that you just described, though, the person in the bar who threatens to assault somebody, and with some type of dangerous instrument, is actually already covered in the law. That would be one of the various forms of assault, depending on how they communicated that threat and how they and how that occurred. The way that we have attempted to ensure that we don't make this particular statute too broad is that it is place another person in reasonable fear of serious physical injury. Serious physical injury has a very specific definition under the law, and it's not just any injury. So it's not just I'm going to punch you. It has to be a serious. It has to be grave bodily injury, injury that would cause a substantial interference with your bodily functions, right? So we think of being shot, think of severely damaged body parts.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a minute, because if the fellow in the bar has a firearm, there's something that already covers it, but what if he doesn't, and the serious, it would meet the definition of serious physical injury, such as strangling or something that, you know, I think would fall under, or maybe we need to understand the serious physical injury, what that means. Would it, I just want to make sure we're not casting too wide of a net here.
Madam Chair, you know, there is, if I am sure that there's a factual scenario in which has the potential to be captured in terrorist threatening that is not captured in the assault statute. However, when we would be looking at that from, you know, the filing of criminal charges, we'd be looking at the specific intent of that language. What are we trying to accomplish? We're not trying to criminalize every potential bar fight. What we're trying to create is a scenario in which law enforcement has the tools to really intervene in that threat, that school threat, that safety threat, that sort of thing.
And that is why I want this discussion on the record, so that it'll be clear what this intent, and I'm sure law enforcement would realize that, but I just, because that's a single item and they were separated by the word or, I thought it was important. Senator Keel, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So you initially said that in the past the false threat was covered as an aggregated form of, and I didn't write it down, an aggregated form of some other offense. Did I misunderstand?
So through the chair, Senator, the commentary to terrorist threatening, the current law, terrorist threatening, is referred to as an aggravated form of making a false report.
False report. And so the
follow-up, Senator Keel?
Follow-up for me, thank you. The benefit of switching it here would be a more serious offense, I take it? Terrorist threatening two would be more serious than aggravated false report?
So, through the chair, Senator, it would be the same level of offense. We're not changing the severity. It would still be a C felony. What we're trying to do is we're trying to create a statute that allows us to make sure that we have a crime that covers the threat when it's real as opposed to when it's false. So one of the necessary elements of current terrorist threatening is the threat or the report has to be false. The threat has to be false. So if you say, I'm going to blow up the school tomorrow, and it's just a joke, that would be covered. But if you had an intent to follow through with that, that would not be covered right now. And that's what we need to cover. And that's why we need this provision. We need a section of the criminal code to make sure that we have the ability to stop that from happening.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michikee.
Just if you sort of better explain 1156.810 the way it exists, I think that's kind of the key. It's almost written verbatim, including the or. This essentially just changes it from making a false report to committing the crime of terrorist threatening. Before it required that it be a false report. Now it can be either, as long as that threat is communicated. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that's correct.
Thank you. Continue.
Section 28 returns disorderly conduct to returns disorderly conduct to a Class B misdemeanor punishable up to 10 days in jail. SB 91 made the maximum penalty for disorderly conduct 24 hours. This returns that disorderly conduct of Class B to up to 10 days in jail. Again, returning the discretion both back to the court and to the prosecution to handle these situations of disorderly conduct. Moving on to...
I'm sorry, I just missed it. What was it prior to... what did SB 91 do?
It made this...
24 hours?
Yeah.
Okay,
Madam Chair, yeah, made it 24 hours.
Okay, thank you.
So moving to sections 29, I'm going to talk about each section individually, but I wanted to highlight for the committee. Sections 29 through 37, these sections collectively return our drug laws to what they were pre-SB 91. I'm going to talk about them one by one, but collectively, sections 29 to 37 returns us to our pre-SB 91 law. And the committee should have the matrix that the Department of Law prepared that describes the law pre-SB 91, what SB 91 did, and then what the governor's crime package collectively does. Specifically, it has two specific aspects of that matrix that will be relevant to this conversation, both one, drug possession, and then two, drug distribution. So I'm going to start with sections 29. Sections 29 reenacts the offense of the crime of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree. This is a Class A felony offense for the distribution of any amount of a Schedule 1A controlled substance, which is your Schedule 1A's, those are your opioids or opioid derivatives. So your heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, morphine. Those drugs that are highly dangerous, highly addictive, those are Schedule 1A controlled substances in Alaska. So Section 29 makes the distribution of any amount of a Schedule 1A drug an A felony. It also returns the manufacture of methamphetamine to a Class A felony offense. One of the things that SB 91 did is it took the manufacture of methamphetamine in the state and took it out of the Class A felony offense and put it into the Class B felony offense. So this Section 29 puts that back, it takes it back to the Class A felony offense. Section 30 renames AS 1171-030 to misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree and amends the statute to include the distribution of any amount of a 2A or a 3A controlled substance. So when you think of 2A controlled substances, think of your cocaines, your methamphetamine, LSD, PCP, mushrooms, you know, those very dangerous, highly addictive stimulants. Your 3A, I want to make sure I get this right, and your 3A or your what we normally see would be your anabolic steroids or your depending on this circumstance, depending on the how it's manufactured, spice. So Section 30 amends misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree for the distribution of any 2 or 3A controlled substance. It also repeals the section of law that required that the distribution of 1 gram or more of a Schedule 1A drug or 2.5 grams of a Schedule 2A or 3A controlled substance. It repeals that section. That's Section 30, page 16. 17.
Mr. Henderson, yes. This is getting in the weeds a bit, but I must be missing something, because when I look at Section 29, we're talking about an A felony for distributing and manufacturing Class 1A drugs.
Uh-huh.
And then when I look on page 17 at the top, which is part of Section 30, where now we're talking about third degree, we're still talking about manufacturing, and it again mentions 1A. So what's the difference? Is it the weight? It's a smaller amount?
No. So, Madam Chair, thank you. Let me walk through each subsection of 30, and I think this will answer that question.
Okay.
So most of what's currently in misconduct involving – I'm going to – so the record's clear. Most of the things that are currently in AS 71030A are going to be repealed by Section 50. What's going to remain – is the distribution of any 2A or 3A controlled substance, the distribution of any 4, 5, or 6 near a school, distribution to a person under the age of 19, or possession near a school. So let me walk you through that. So looking at page 16, section 30, sections sub little a, 1, capital A, the manufacture, delivery, possession, or intent, that's been repealed. And that you find that repeal in Section 50. Okay. The same thing for capital B, capital C, capital D. Subsection 2 remains.
May I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you just showing that repealed here for us now? So why was it, why are you doing it in Section 50? I'm just curious.
That was a drafting decision that we included the repealers all together, and I'll just tell you for me, because I intended to do this, I actually had to take a pencil and go through and mark these out. So I want to walk through these so you all know.
Okay, Senator Rangel.
I want to say I've noticed a lot of bills. They do that. They put all the repealers on the very back of the bill. Yep. I've noticed, and then it takes me forever to pull out all the statutes and so I do know that almost all the bills I've looked at. That's
so, so through the chair, Senator, I am not a drafter, but I will say in the drafter's defense, it is a standard protocol, mm-hmm. and I think it's expected to do it that way.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you. I appreciate you covering it on the record, but it would be very helpful. I mean, I'm generally fairly skilled at following through bills, but repealers do throw a wrench in it. If you have an opportunity to mark them up for what is in the repealers, that would be very helpful, even after you describe it today, Madam Chair.
Yeah, it would be. You're envisioning something where he's crossed out and then provides us a copy of that, particularly for these drug classifications are confusing enough. So thank you. Senator Rangel.
Yeah, and I'd just like to reiterate, we did this yesterday in State Affairs. We're used to being able to say the original text is in one color and the new text is in another color. I don't know how Department of Administration does it, but I use those all the time. And then it goes, you know, right in the copy of the law that we're looking at. And as soon as we get a committee substitute over here, but it sounds like we may not get that opportunity in this committee because she said we weren't going to be allowed to amend the bill, then we may not have that opportunity, which is really difficult. So I don't know if your drafters can do that for us or not, but I have asked for 2 weeks for that over in our legal department, and they said they cannot do it because it's not in our possession. It's in administration's possession.
Okay. So, Chair, Senator, I think that's something we can help with. I think having a marked up copy would be helpful to the committee.
I'm going to take an Addies for a moment. Continue, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm going to quickly go through Section 30 as to what has been deleted and highlight what has remained. So Sections A1 has been repealed in Section 50. Sections A4, so dropping down on page 17, that's still the manufacturer of methamphetamine. Sections A4 has been repealed. Sections A5, that's your possession of immediate precursors to methamphetamines, that has been repealed because that was moved to the A felony. Subsection A6, still on page 17, possession of listed chemicals to manufacture methamphetamine, again, that's been repealed because that was moved to misconduct involving the controlled substance in the second degree. Moving to page 18, sections A7, possess methamphetamine in organic solution, A8, and then those have both been repealed. And then moving down to the new subsection 9A9, this remains this bolded area. This is the distribution of a 2 or a 3 a controlled substance. This is the added language. So moving to sections 31, 31 is a conforming amendment to the change that we saw in section 30. Sections 32, Section 32 reinstates the prior misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth degree. This makes the possession of any amount of a controlled substance 1A a felony, the heroin, and any 2A meth or cocaine felony, and various amounts of a 3, 4, 5, or AC felony. And you'll see that looking at page 18, section 32, and then going Moving to page 19, sections 1 and 2 are not changed, and then subsection 3 possesses any amount. These are the provisions that move the possession of these very dangerous drugs back to the felony level.
Senator Michiki.
Two quick questions. Already had some calls from people in the business. Can you clarify that folks that are licensees possessing the legal amounts of marijuana are not brought under this, and the same for the growing the legal quantity as per their licenses are also not a part of this change?
Madam Chair, Senator, you're absolutely right. 1171 deals with the unregulated or illegal marijuana market. It does not touch upon or reach into 1738, which is our regulated marijuana industry.
So follow up.
Senator Michiki.
And along with this change back to, so this is a full repeal, along with that change back is also the full repeal of the sentencing changes. So the A felony, the B felony, the A and B felony that the distribution is returned to goes back to the prior sentencing guidelines before 91 passed.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Thank you. Senator Reichel.
Thank you. Those were excellent questions, and I think we're in a lot of agreement up here overall. So if there's any, you know, misconception out there that we're not, we are working together in regards to this issue. And we're just getting clarification on the record. But I just really wanted to say, I think this is some of the most important part of all four of the crime bills that are out there right now. There is a person that's sitting two rows behind you that has been exposing this, Mr. Duxbury, and doing an outstanding job of this, saying, and I have learned in all the ride-alongs that I have been going on from every angle of law enforcement, from prosecution, from the victim, from the everybody I've been talking to, that this has been one of the core problems. They start carrying, possessing drugs, then, you know, it could eventually lead to using, which can lead to theft, because then they need, you know, money to feed their habit. Then it could get into burglary or, you know, invading people's homes or robbery or assault or even homicide. And so I am just so thankful. This bill is incredibly important, and I can't say strongly enough how important. I just wish it was on the floor. I know we have to go through the process, but I don't think that we can get these tools back in law enforcement quick enough.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Henderson, proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So to the committee, Senator Rembold, I think you make a very important point. One of the things that we have done in this bill is we have reprioritized the possession of drugs, reprioritized the prosecution and interdiction of drug offenses, and that's what you see throughout this bill. Moving to sections 33, if section 33 is a conforming amendment to the changes made in 32, sections 34 reinstate the prior misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree. This is a Class A misdemeanor, and it removes the possession of the most dangerous drugs, the heroin, meth, cocaine, from that misdemeanor level, as we saw in the prior section. Moving to sections 35 renames AS 1171-060, misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree. This is a return back to the pre-2016 law, conform with the changes we made throughout the drug statute generally. Moving to sections 36, these are conforming amendments to the what we sometimes refer to as the Good Samaritan Law in Alaska. This is the statute that prohibits the prosecution of individuals for the possession, for certain drug offenses when that individual seeks medical or law enforcement intervention.
Since we kind of got through the drug classification changes, basically what we had before 91, we had 6 degrees, and then we went to 5, and now we're going back to 6, because we had pulled one out, and that's just what all these sections were shifting things back.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We moved everything, essentially, we moved everything down one, with the exception of the unclassified misconduct involving controlled substance in the first degree.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, question.
Senator Michiki.
So on the drug possessions that are now returned to a Class C felony and a Class A misdemeanor, in the felony case, I guess the word I would call is retained the section where a suspended sentence is possible to provide a treatment plan if it's a first-timer whose life we want to help turn around, Is that correct? Can you explain that?
Through the chair, Senator, you're absolutely correct. We actually have a couple of tools now that we didn't have in before SB 91. One is the suspended imposition of sentence, which we've always had. But now we also have what's called an SCJ, or a suspended entry of judgment. Suspended entry of judgment is a form of a sentence agreement where if somebody is goes through treatment, does everything that they're supposed to do, that conviction, that judgment will never be entered, and that conviction won't stand.
Thank you.
So moving to Section 37, this increases the maximum period of probation for felony sex offenses from 15 years to 25 years. It also increases the maximum period of probation for all other offenses to 10 years. One of the things SB 91 did is it limited the length of time a person could be put on probation, depending on which offense they were convicted of. This returns that discretion to the court and allows the court to put somebody on probation for the length of time necessary based on that judge's independent judgment as to what would be appropriate and necessary.
What happens if someone were sentenced during the period SB 91 was in effect? Does this apply to them, or will they have the shorter probation periods?
Madam Chair, I am thinking because that has to do with the applicability sections. A person would be, the criminal penalties that would govern that criminal conduct would be what existed at the time they committed the offense.
And can you tell us again what they were? Because I know they're 25 and 10, but what were they before?
So before SB 91?
No, I mean, what are they now?
Okay. So pre-2016, felony sex offenses were 25 years, up to 25 years probation, and all of other offenses were 10 years. Under the current law, felony sex offenses has a maximum probation term of 15 years. Crimes against a person have a maximum term of 10 years. Felony non-person crimes have a maximum term of 5 years. Misdemeanor person crimes have a maximum term of 3 years. Misdemeanor DUI has a maximum term of 2 years. And then all other offenses, so all your other misdemeanors, 1 year. We return back to 25 years for felony sex offenses and 10 years for all other offenses.
And again, I think this section is so important, and I think in State Affairs yesterday we talked about this in length, about how offenders were doing so much better when they were on probation, especially the sex offenders. So I am so happy to see this in this bill.
Senator Matiki, did you have a question?
Well, I have a question for back on the drug distribution. I may be interested in, and I know we may not because of the conflict and because our chair is a stickler for following every section of the law. In the next committee, I may be interested in an escalator on the maximum felony sentencing for certain quantities of distribution. Is that something your department can help me with, understanding how that could be executed?
So through the chair, Senator, if you have questions as to what the impact or the effect of those type of sentencing enhancements would be, we're absolutely available to help.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have one going back, but let us keep going forward. Can you give an example of a misdemeanor that needs 10 years probation?
Through the chair, Senator, yes. So think of a theft case in which there's the restitution is outstanding. and the alternative is to have that restitution judgment become a civil judgment that the victim has to execute upon on themselves. They don't have the benefit of the criminal justice system anymore. There may be a circumstance in which we want, it would be important to put somebody on misdemeanor probation to ensure that they pay restitution. Mm-hmm. That may be one scenario. There may be another scenario where, given the circumstances, you need the person on probation longer than somebody else because they need more time to meet the conditions of their probation. So one of the things that I think is important to note is that these are maximum terms, not minimums and not required. So what this really allows the court to do is to say, do I need to put this misdemeanor on probation for 10 years? Maybe not. But if I need to, if the circumstances that are, they come up, and that's necessary and important, now the judge has that discretion.
Senator Kim? I know that when it comes to sentences, we have a whole series of aggravators. Do those, for those sort of extreme cases you mentioned, do those apply to probation at all?
Through the chair, Senator, no. The aggravators adjust the presumptive range. They don't adjust the probationary term.
Thanks.
Continue, please.
Sections, I'm on Section 38. Section 38, Sections 38 through 40. This is the return of all presumptive sentencing ranges to their pre-SB 91 or pre-2016 ranges. So I'll go through them, but think of it in the way of what SB 91 did was it took all the presumptive ranges and kind of moved them all down. This returns those all to that previous level. So to understand presumptive ranges, when somebody commits a felony offense, their sentence is really dictated by two factors. One is the classification of their offense. So is it an unclassified A, B, or C felony? And then combined with their criminal history. And their criminal history will then give you a range of where that sentence should go, everything else being equal. That range is where the court can live when he or she pronounces that sentence. To go above or below that range, the court has to find either an aggravator or a mitigator, depending on the circumstances of the case. So what 38 does, I'm starting with Section 38. Section 38 adjusts all the presumptive ranges for Class A felonies back to where they were. So that's where you see it includes both the range itself, but also then the range that applies to what we sometimes refer to as special circumstances. Special circumstances are those offenses in which somebody commits an A felony and they possessed a firearm, used a dangerous instrument, or caused serious physical injury. Those are those special circumstances. When somebody is convicted of an offense and those circumstances apply, they face a higher presumptive range. And then moving to, still in Section 38, but moving to page 25, you'll see that we return the enhanced penalty for making methamphetamine around children. So we return that to the 7 to 11 presumptive range. That's an enhanced special circumstance. Moving to Sections 39 returned the sentencing ranges for all Class B felony offenses to what they were pre-2016. And then along with the return of the enhanced sentencing provisions for Class B felony offense for somebody making methamphetamine, the attempt to make methamphetamine around children. Moving to Sections 40, 40 is the return of the presumptive ranges for Class C felony offenses. One thing I would point out in Section 40 is that, if you recall, SB 91 made the presumptive range for a first-time Class C felony offense a presumptive probationary term of 18 months. That was amended and put to 0 to 2 in SB 54. This SB 32, this bill, page 26, Section 40, leaves that change because that's what it was pre-SB 91. So again, what we're doing is we're going back to the pre-2016 sentencing law. Moving to Section 41.
Question.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. Quick question. So 20 max would include an aggravator above the 5 to 8, 10 to 14, or 15 to 20. Correct. When I asked that question earlier, would a judge take excessive amounts of drugs that were to be distributed in the conviction into account as an aggravator, or is that something that we should specify, which was kind of my question earlier?
So through the chair, Senator, so there is a specific aggravator for what we refer to as a large amount. So a large amount allows the court to go beyond that presumptive range and the top end. And so the large amount is unique to the facts of that case. So I'll give you an example. A large amount in Kotzebue, Alaska is different than a large amount in downtown Anchorage. Hmm. That's one of the reasons why when in our distribution and in our drug laws, we don't want to specify the amount for those very serious drugs. It's important so to allow the judge to have the discretion to really understand what's the impact that drug had in that community on that day. And that may be a large amount for that community on that day, and that would allow the judge to exceed the presumptive range if that aggravator is found.
Okay, one more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki.
Seems to me like the maximum, including aggravators, and I'll just pick Class A felonies as an example, you would expect that the max would be a sliding scale as opposed to them all being a 20 max. Can you just give me a quick answer why a third felony 20-year max is the same as a first felony 20-year max?
So through the chair, Senator, it's based on the classification system that we have in Alaska law. We have made a decision to have essentially four classes of felonies, and those classifications then always dictate a maximum term. So for example, the maximum term for all C felonies is 5 years. For all B felonies, it's 10 years. And all Class A felonies, it's 20 years. Unclassifieds, they're unclassified for a reason, because most of those go up to 99 years. But that's how we have chosen to classify offenses. We have a maximum, and then we have ranges within that maximum. And then depending on the situation, we have mandatory minimums as well.
Thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
Just to echo again off of Senator Chiggy, where are the it just seems like Alaska has so many cases where there is no minimum, mandatory minimum. I'm a believer in the mandatory minimums, but when I read the statutes, there's just not all that many cases where mandatory minimums are. I mean, I don't know if you could put anything,
sure.
You know, in regards to the record, but everything seems to be 0 to 365 or 0 to... You know,
sure.
Anyway.
So I'm going to go a little bit from memory here, but there are minimums kind of throughout the code. For example, murder of a police officer, that's a mandatory minimum of 99 years. We have a three strikes and you're out provision. If you commit three A or unclassified offenses in series in a certain manner, then you are mandatory minimum 99 years. We have mandatory minimums for assault on a police officer if it's a misdemeanor assault. Depending on the type of assault, it's either 30 days or 60 days. We have a mandatory minimum on driving under the influence. So for a first-time DUI, it's a mandatory minimum of 3 days. For a second DUI, it's a mandatory minimum of 20 days. And then we have mandatory minimums for felony DUI as well. So they're not... They are throughout the code, and if you have a particular question as to a particular mandatory minimum, I can try to answer that question.
Well, Senator Reinbold.
So I guess I've compared with Texas law, and mm-hmm. ours are soft as can be compared to so many in Texas and even Wyoming, you know, some other ranges at a big level. I know maybe not a good time to be discussing that, but I can tell you that is in the back of our minds in regards to minimums. It's really to deter. If the governor is serious about making us one of the most safest states in the nation, after he stated this last Saturday night, we can't, even pre-Senate Bill 91, I mean, our laws aren't that harsh. So it's just something to consider. I know it's a much more global picture in the big, but that is definitely, in this replace effort, something that I want to look at very seriously. There's a lot of opportunist criminals up here. In Alaska right now, and I do believe it. Even pre-SB 91, we still had considerable crime in this state. And I just think having a minimum, I mean, criminals know the law. A lot of them do, and I just think that's an important discussion, maybe not for today, but for in the future.
And I will say that I have had concerns too. We want the discretion factor back because that's a powerful tool. But I know the public has been outraged when if a judge chooses to go to the bottom, which is the zero on some of these things. And in fact, I had a number of people that spoke to me concerned about the criminal statutes in the last couple of years, and when they tell their story, it's actually something that occurred in 2012 or 13. So it was, as Senator Reinbold said, there is an opportunity to relook at these things, and I think that is a wise thing to do. You can go ahead and proceed, or if you want to comment on that.
Madam Chair, I was looking for something, and I think at this point, given the time, I'll proceed.
Thank you.
So moving on to sections 41, just restores the prior language to clarify that probation or the suspended portion of a sentence in a sex offense cannot be reduced. Sections 42 returns the sentencing range for all Class A misdemeanors back to 0 to 365 days, and not in incarceration, not in just certain cases. Sections 43 returns all Class B misdemeanors back to the 0 to 90 days range, not the 10-day limitation that was imposed by SB 91. Sections 44 reenacts a prohibition of active jail times for certain individuals convicted of possession of marijuana. Sections 45 repeals their.
Oh, Senator Kuehl.
Thank you. As we shift out of the sort of the main sentence segments, I guess one of the things that strikes me about this bill is that it's kind of a double tap. Not only do each of the things we talked about earlier become a higher order of crime, misdemeanor to felony, or you know, in some cases a C to a beer A, but we also then propose to increase the sentences for each order. I don't know what the term is, level, each level of offense. And so I guess a question about what we think is, which we think are the effective operators, which things actually do we think serve to deter? And I guess the context is a few years ago we raised the penalties for some of our most severe violent crimes. Those have been in effect for a while. I mean, have those crimes gone down? Where are the deterrents that work best?
So, through the chair, Senator, it really what we're talking about is you're right. There are in some circumstances we're elevating both the criminal offense and the criminal penalty, but what we're doing is we're increasing that ceiling. We're not necessarily increasing the sentence if it's not necessary. So again, what we're doing is we're making sure the judge is the person who gets to make that decision. Based on the circumstances of the individual standing before the judge. So the judge gets to say, this person with these circumstances, given this criminal act and these convictions, this is an appropriate sentence. And that's important because what that really does is that reaffirms for the judge that the court needs to apply all of the sentencing factors, not just deterrence, not just rehabilitation, not just community condemnation, but really has to take all of those things into account and really weigh them equally, or excuse me, not equally, they have to weigh them appropriately. So in some cases, rehabilitation is going to be the number one most important sentencing factor, absolutely. And there are going to be some cases where it's not going to be rehabilitation, and it's going to be isolation. It's going to be community condemnation. It's going to be restoration of the victim's rights. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that the judge has the options available to make and to impose that sentence when appropriate.
So we
follow up, Senator Kuehl.
So we don't have a deterrent effect on stopping people from committing the crime in the first place.
So through the chair, Senator, it sounds like your question is like does the theoretical concept of deterrence work? And I don't know. I'm not a social scientist, I can't answer that question. I know that it's something that we're mandated to consider. We have to consider it. We have to consider both the deterrence for the specific offender and deterrence for this community as a whole. So we do have situations where deterrence does work. We know it works. You know, think of the DUI context, right? There is a general deterrence that if you pick up a DUI, there's a mandatory 3-day in jail, mandatory minimum. Everybody knows it. Everybody is on notice that if you commit a DUI, in addition to all the other penalties that are going to occur, you're going to have 3 days of incarceration. Now, how that incarceration looks and what how you have to serve that incarceration is something actually we're going to talk about in the next section. But that is an example where the general public knows you commit this offense, this is going to happen.
Just the final follow-up on that point. But you said we know that has a deterrent effect. How do we know that has a deterrent effect?
So through the chair, Senator, I think with regard to DUI, what you'd see is, and I'm not a social scientist, but I would be willing. My memory is that if you look at DUIs over the last 30 years, they have dropped considerably. And one of the reasons, there's a lot of different reasons for that, but one of those is the mandatory incarceration, mandatory minimums. It is lowering the BAC. It is the collateral consequences of the driver's license, but it's also making sure that there are consequences that are required. And we see this actually throughout, I'll stop there.
And I will just add, if you know of any cab drivers that have been driving for 30 years, you could ask them if they're doing more pickups on Friday and Saturday nights. I think that they are, and I think that a person does think twice. And I will also add that in conversations with law enforcement officers in South Central, this is kind of the flip side. I'm hearing that the last couple of years that we've had an influx of criminals from out of state because of the softening of our laws. So that's the flip side of it. So if we toughen them up, we should slow down and hopefully stop that importation so that we can focus on Alaskans. So continue, please.
Okay. So moving to Section 45. Section 45 actually repeals a requirement that offenders serve their sentence for the first DUI on electronic monitoring or house arrest. This actually returns the discretion to the Department of Corrections to determine the appropriate placement. Section 46 is a similar change to what we saw in Section 45, but it just as applied to refusal to submit to a chemical test. Section 47 is a conforming amendment to the Alaska Landlord-Tenant Act.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. Backing up to 46, as I've watched the DUI statutes over the years, generally we've had the same sanction, same approach if you refuse to blow as if you blow high. So why would we then take refusal to submit to a chemical test and apply a different standard for serving your 3 days?
Through the chair, Senator, I think I may be confused by your question. What actually 45 and 46 does is it actually allows for the same amount of discretion.
So you could serve refusal to submit to a chemical test on electronic monitoring?
If approved by the Department of Corrections.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I must have misread.
Sections 47... is a conforming amendment to the Alaska Landlord-Tenant Act with the changes to the drug statutes. Sections 48, conforming amendments to the list of crimes that are covered by Department of Health and Human Services, Juvenile Justice. Sections 49 is not related to SB 91. This is a change that would allow to ensure that the Alaska court system can transmit and transfer information regarding involuntary commitments to the Department of Public Safety for years prior to 2014. So, and then Department of Correction, excuse me, the Department of Public Safety would then have that information and available to upload into the national database. Moving to Section 50. Again, Section 50 is not related to SB 91. This is really a rule of efficiency for the prosecution. This amends Criminal Rule 6R, which governs the admissibility of certain evidence at grand jury. What this amendment does is it allows the prosecution to introduce a person's criminal history electronically as opposed to using those certified judgments when appropriate and when necessary to prove the existence of predicate offenses. So think recidivist theft, recidivist assault, felon in possession type offenses. This allows us to use that electronic record as opposed to waiting for the certified judgment, because if we have to wait for that certified judgment and we're not able to get that certified judgment, we are not able to hold that person on the felony charge, meaning we have to dismiss the felony charge or we have to reduce that charge to a misdemeanor and hold them on a misdemeanor. So this is both an efficiency, this is an efficiency change. 51.
And just so the public and the members understand, those certified copies, the delays, it involves getting things from other states and waiting for agencies from other states, and it can be quite the delay. So this is a very sensible item, I think.
Moving to sections 51. 51 is the repealers. This is where we see several repeals. I think we have touched upon them throughout the sectional analysis. 52 is the applicability section. 53.
Senator Keel?
On the repealers, is there a change in the DV look back?
Through the chair, Senator, I believe there is a repeal of the look back of prior convictions for misdemeanors, and that's in part because we're returning the discretion to the court for on a misdemeanor for up to 365 days. So it's because we've eliminated that cap that exists, that now the court has doesn't need that look back period, because now the court has the authority to sentence appropriately within that entire range. If that makes sense.
I don't think I follow.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Actually, I didn't follow it either. So could you try again?
Yes. So let me try it a different way. So when under current law, under SB 91, there's a cap for on Class A misdemeanors of 30 days. A court can impose a sentence of 365 days if the person has prior convictions or it's a certain offense. So we had a prior conviction section unique to the misdemeanor code. We've repealed that section of the definition of prior convictions because we've now just said on misdemeanors, the court has the discretion to impose up to a year, taking into account all of the facts and circumstances.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay.
And then one other on the on the repealers. Statutory aggravators counting toward, I'm going to get this wrong, they used to be able to count toward the elements of an offense, but but not the sentence.
So
one of the other rules, wasn't it?
So through the chair, Senator, there is a rule, it's called the June B rule, actually, that doesn't allow us to double count. So in other words, you can't if it's the element of the offense, you can't double count it and also make it an aggravating factor to exceed that presumptive range. That's always been the law. Well, it's not always been law. It's been the law since the Alaska Court of Appeals issued the June B case. It's called the June B rule. We're not allowed to double count.
And so are we repealing something?
We through the chair, Senator, we are repealing the June B version of the rule for misdemeanors. We're repealing the June B rule for purposes of misdemeanors because we've eliminated the sentencing cap and aggravating factors for misdemeanors generally. So since now the court has that overall range to impose the sentence appropriate and the aggravators have been repealed, you don't need the double counting provision for misdemeanors because we don't have misdemeanor aggravating factors anymore.
Thank you.
Um, So moving to Section 52, Section 52 is the applicability section and provisions. Section 53 is the retroactivity provision that makes Section 49, which was the data sharing between the court system and DPS, that makes that retroactive. 54, conditional effect regarding the court rule change. We saw that in the criminal rule 6R change. And then 55 is the effective date and the immediate effective date for sections 49 and 50. And then the remainder of the act becomes effective upon July 1, 2019.
Okay. Looking at the clock, you hit it right on the nose here. And I'm sure Mr. Henderson would be happy to answer any questions people have, if you want to set up an appointment with him as well. So thank you for getting us through the entire bill. Just a reminder that tomorrow, Saturday 9th, we will have public testimony starting at 1 p.m. And I look forward to those of you that can be here tomorrow will be in this room. And that concludes our business today. So let the record reflect that we're adjourning at 3 o'clock p.m.